We're discussing the state of the pandemic in Wisconsin on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers highlighted Wisconsin's vaccination effort yesterday in the state media briefing on the public health response.
Just this weekend, we were ranked second in the country and first in the Midwest for using available vaccine supply. That means we are using our available supply faster than any other state in the Midwest.
But Evers said we're not out of the woods yet as daily COVID cases continue to rise. What do you want to know about the status of vaccines, especially the J&J? Have you been able to get vaccinated? 800-642-1234. Dr. Ryan Westergaard is Chief Medical Officer and State Epidemiologist for Communicable Diseases for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Dr. Westergaard, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate, and thank you for the invitation to join you today.
So what is going on with this rising case count?
Well, it's probably a couple of things. The epidemiology of COVID-19 is changing with a pretty significant shift toward the new genetic variants. There's a subset of the virus that is circulating that is more highly transmissible, and we've seen this sort of spreading throughout the world, and it's now here in Wisconsin, a significant proportion. Probably over half of the cases that being detected are these more highly transmissible variants. So that's our best guess of what the leading cause is, but there's probably other things as well.
Okay, and so when you say these more contagious variants, is this specifically B.1.1.7 or other variants also emerging here?
Yes, the B.1.1.7, as you said, was the first one that was detected in December in the United Kingdom, and that is the largest share of the novel variants, but there are other ones as well. This is something that we watch closely by doing genome sequencing on a subset of the positive tests, and we're seeing it week by week increase. But right now, yes, B.1.1.7 is the predominant strain.
So there's quite a bit of surveillance going on of the tests that come back here in Wisconsin. Which age groups are testing positive for the virus? Do you see anything jump out there?
Yeah, there's been a significant shift in that as well. When you look at our big epidemic wave that occurred in November and December, it was older Wisconsin residents who were sort of leading the way. The age group that was the under 18 had the smallest proportion during that first fall and winter wave. It's completely flipped now. Right now, in the past several weeks, the age cohort, meaning the age group of people 18 and under, have the highest number of new infections. So it's really been a shift toward infections in younger people.
And that 20 to 29 age group as well, I'm seeing that really jump out.
Yeah, it's definitely been a shift. And I think it's probably two things. One is that we've focused on older folks for our early phases of vaccine administration. And it's without question true that we've prevented a lot of cases by vaccinating people. And for example, our 65 and older have had, you know, nearly 80% of the population has been vaccinated. So that's made a big difference. But there's also increased interaction, increased social gatherings among younger people. And as the weather gets nicer, as people are doing sports and activities outdoors, and I think that's playing a role as well.
What do you think about the impact of in-person schooling resuming, extracurricular activities?
Well, one of the things that we've learned, you know, pretty well over the past several months is that school can be done safely. In-person school can be done safely if we really pay attention to the multiple layers of prevention strategies. And that includes wearing masks, keeping social distance, and having small cohorts of students. When we do those things well, in-person school is safe. The absolute wrong thing to do right now would be to come back to school doing any of those things less. So I think that instruction in classrooms can be done safely, but we can't let our guard down. We have to continue to wear masks and enforce mask rules in school districts. And then if we do that, I think school itself will be safe. The other activities, as you mentioned, outside of school, sports, again, we need to have consistent mask wearing, social distancing. We can't let our guard down.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Ryan Westergaard, Chief Medical Officer for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, and we're looking at the situation with the pandemic now in Wisconsin. What do you see where you are? What's your reaction to our COVID cases rising? Are you surprised? Are you still seeing people who are social distancing and wearing masks? 800-642-1234. Dr. Westergaard, we have an email here from Saul in Stevens Point. Saul is concerned about the P1 variant from Brazil in Wisconsin. And does it represent a danger to unvaccinated people in Wisconsin and across the U.S.?
Yes, I think taken as a group, the novel variants in P1 and P2 are the frankly not very catchy names that we've given the variants that emerged in Brazil. They do pose a risk. They're all being studied actively, so we're learning more about them. In addition to being more highly transmissible, for example, for the B117, we do have some evidence that it causes more severe disease as well. So these are a more dangerous form of the virus. The good news is that the vaccines protect against these variants quite well. So getting vaccinated is a good way to prevent severe illness, even in the face of these new circulating strains.
Well, let's talk vaccines. Johnson & Johnson, the FDA and CDC telling states to hit pause there on the J&J vaccine to stop distributing it due to safety concerns. Wisconsin DHS has followed suit, pausing injections. Can you describe for us the concerns about this vaccine?
Yes, this was big news yesterday, and it's taking a lot of careful communication because it's a bit of a complex topic. The adverse event that was described in a small number of vaccine recipients of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is something called cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, which is a relatively rare type of blood clot that can cause stroke. And what was distinctive about this is that it also occurred in the setting of low platelets. And this raised the suspicion that it's a similar phenomenon, a similar type of rare adverse events that was seen in Europe with a similar vaccine, the adenovirus vector vaccine made by Oxford and AstraZeneca, that was in the news several months ago, also causing blood clots. So we think we are now detecting a new autoimmune phenomenon that occurs in a very small subset of people that can cause blood clots through this somewhat unique pathway. Now, the important thing to understand is that the pause of the vaccine is not because we think the vaccine is too dangerous to use. It's rather because we really need to fully understand this new illness, this new side effect, so we can educate the population about what is the risk with a fair level of precision, what they need to look for, and also let the whole medical community who's involved in administering vaccines and treatments to understand fully what this situation looks like and what how to counsel their patients. So we're optimistic that when we get through this next investigation, we will be armed with better knowledge about this adverse effect, but are cautiously optimistic that it's not going to limit the use of the vaccine. It's just appropriately we are collecting more information so we can give people the best advice about how to proceed safely with vaccination.
And here in Wisconsin, 160,000 doses of the J&J vaccine have been administered. If people have received this one, what should they be watching out for, or what should they do?
So what we've observed so far in people who have developed this complication is an illness that starts about between 5 days after receiving the vaccine and no more than 3 weeks after the vaccine. So it's a relatively early phenomenon. People who have received the vaccine more than a month ago really shouldn't worry about anything. And also, people that develop headache or flu-like symptoms on day one or two after the vaccine, which as many people know is very common, shouldn't also worry. The things to look for this rare and specific adverse event would be a severe headache that starts in that 1 week to 3 week period. Vision changes, sometimes abdominal pain and leg pain can be signs of blood clots as well. And this other aspect of the adverse event of low platelets, that can show up as very easy bruising, bleeding gums when you brush your teeth, or small spots called petechiae that can reflect, small hemorrhages or bleeding in the skin. So those, again, very rare things, but people should know of what to look for if they have received the vaccine recently.
We're talking with state epidemiologist for communicable diseases. Ryan Westergaard is here as we discuss the state response to the pandemic, the concerns about the J&J vaccine, what's happening now with it. Have you stopped social distancing or wearing a mask? What is your reasoning? Is it because you're fully vaccinated? Do you have questions about COVID variants that are circulating? Join in your questions about COVID, 800-642-1234. Dr. Westergaard will be back with us in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we talk about the state response to the pandemic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Are you fully vaccinated or on your way to that point? What do you want to know about COVID spread in Wisconsin? What do you want to know about mask wearing, other public health aspects of this pandemic? 800-642-1234. We have Dr. Ryan Westergaard, the top state health official for communicable diseases. He's with us for 10 more minutes. Dr. Westergaard, we heard from a teacher called in, couldn't stay with us. They wanted to know if students should be masked during outside recess. And the teacher says students at their school wear masks indoors, inside, but not outside. And students also don't social distance well outside at recess. What can you say there?
I think the risk of transmission in outdoor settings is lower. But if you are engaging in activities that bring you in close proximity to another person, the risk is not zero. So my suggestion would be that if kids are comfortable wearing masks inside, it's safer to keep masks on outside during outdoor activities as well. And that's just as the caller mentioned, because it's hard to maintain social distancing. So all of these things are, you know, pieces of the puzzle. There's not one thing that makes or breaks a safe environment. But my suggestion would be to wear masks as much as is practical in school settings, and that includes outside.
Let's go to Julie now from Beaver Dam with the question. Hi, Julie. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm in between shots, so I had my first shot from Pfizer March 30th, and my second shot is April 20th, and I caught a chest cold on top of all my allergies at this point.
And so you're wondering if you should be cleared and go ahead with that second dose? Is that the question?
Yeah, or is the chest cold part of, like, the side effects of the Pfizer?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the side effects of the vaccine can be what we call flu-like, meaning those body aches and the headache that you can get when you have the flu. But they're typically not the respiratory symptoms, the sore throat, the cough, the runny nose, for example. So there's a couple of possibilities. One is, you know, there's a lot of causes for those things. There can be other viruses that are going around. And it's also true that the vaccines aren't fully protective, particularly when you haven't completed the full dose. So it might be reasonable to get a COVID test and see your provider to see if there's any other testing that's appropriate. Having mild illness, though, isn't a contraindication to getting the first or second dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. So shouldn't necessarily delay, but particularly if you've been around other sick people, wouldn't be a bad idea to go ahead and get tested for COVID, because it is possible to still get infected after the first dose.
You know, this is such a race against time with this virus, and we're, you know, nowhere near herd immunity when the virus can no longer spread easily through our communities. What must be done to level off this rising case count we're seeing?
Yeah, it's the things that we've been doing all along. And I think if we would have had to put our energy in one place, it would be for the idea of sustaining our effort. I think the easy thing to do now, you know, a year plus, year and a half into the epidemic, is to just get so sick and tired of this pandemic that we stop doing the things that we've grown accustomed to doing. And mask wearing in public is probably most common among us that I'm hearing. People are saying, well, we're close enough. Can we stop wearing masks? I think that's a mistake at this point, both because, as you said, we're not out of it. We don't have enough people protected from because of vaccination in the community, and these new, more contagious variants are spreading. So as much as we hate to be in this situation, there is still a risk of severe illness for a lot of people. And only by collectively all doing our part, all wearing masks, all continuing the social distancing, can we keep transmission low. In addition to that, which we've been doing all along, participating, having good conversations, talking about our vaccine experience with friends and neighbors who might be considering or hesitant to get the vaccine. These are the things we've got, since more tools than we've ever had to prevent disease. We just need to, keep at it, keep the energy level sustained so we can get through this, because it's not over yet, unfortunately.
We're talking with Dr. Ryan Westergaard, infectious disease physician, chief medical officer for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Ricky is now joining us in Oconomowoc. Hi, Ricky.
Hi. Yeah, my question is about surveillance in general. It seems that there's a heightened sensitivity to the J&J AstraZeneca, but what about Moderna and Pfizer and what the CDC is doing in terms of surveillance of all of the vaccines?
You mean by way of monitoring side effects after
Correct.
Administering them? Okay.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. That's a really important question. And in a lot of conversations we've had over the past 24 hours, the idea has come up quite a bit that this pause, this recognition of this really rare event is a good evidence that the system is working. So what is that system? And we have multiple overlapping systems to detect potential adverse events that occur after vaccination. And the most common one that's been used for a long time is called VAERS, V-A-E-R-S, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. So all providers that administer vaccines are trained to report any vaccine adverse events that they hear about into this system. So that's, all the many millions of vaccines that are given are given by a provider who's been trained and expected to add these things to the system. In addition to that, with COVID-19 vaccine, everyone who gets a vaccine has the opportunity to download a smartphone app and contribute data every day or every week about any symptoms that they're having. So this is an active form of surveillance that's really using the whole population able to be participating in reporting adverse events. And then there's a big team of analysts and experts at CDC poring over the data to see, are we experiencing anything, any level of adverse events that's higher than what we expect in the general population just due to chance. So that was exactly how this really small number of severe adverse events was detected and led to the current situation where we're looking more closely for this. So it's a good question.
As this vaccination, as these vaccinations get approved for younger and younger people, is the state putting together a plan for how children will get vaccinated once they're available?
Yes, and it's going to look very similar to the current strategy. We've at DHS have been working hard to engage as many possible providers of vaccine or vaccine administrators, including healthcare providers and non-traditional providers in health departments and fire departments and county health departments, and schools eventually might be on this list. So we're thinking logistically how to make vaccine available in more, and including non-traditional places to get vaccine. Because as you mentioned earlier, Kate, it's a bit of a race against time and against the variants. Once we hear that the vaccines are authorized for use in younger people, we want to get the vaccine out into arms as quickly as we can. And we've built a good infrastructure to do that so far. And we just need to keep building it and keep extending our reach to provide vaccines in all corners of the state among all eligible populations.
So what I'm hearing here is that, maybe the pediatrician's office would be certainly one place, a starting place, but you're, really thinking much more broadly about this.
I think so. Vaccine, primary care offices have been the mainstay and are a really important partner for giving all vaccines, and that'll continue to be true for COVID vaccines. But this is a very rare, severe, once-in-our-lifetime type of pandemic. So we really are taking an all-hands-on-deck approach, engaging different partners who can give vaccines in other areas, trying to make it as accessible and as easy to administer as possible. And that's required a great deal of work, but we're making good progress.
Circling back once again to vaccine rollout here in Wisconsin, you know, the pausing of the J&J, will that affect our ability to get shots into arms with our supply?
To some degree, but not to a large degree, I would say. The two messenger RNA vaccines, that's the Pfizer and the Moderna, are still representing the lion's share of our vaccines administered, and supply continues to be good for both of those. So there's a lot of places, a lot of venues across the state that have the two Pfizer and Moderna vaccines in good supply, and the supply will continue to be coming in. So I think this is a setback, but as I mentioned, I think we should look at this as an opportunity of the system working right, making sure we understand all the risks before we administer vaccines widely. But we still have good access to the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, and it's also important to note that there's been no occurrence of this blood clotting disorder in those two vaccines. So we don't have any reason to suspect that risk carries to the other one. So people should feel confident getting those other vaccines.
Dr. Westergaard, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Have a great day.
You too. Infectious disease physician Ryan Westergaard, Chief Medical Officer for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services and an Associate Professor in the Department of Medicine in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ahead this hour, Vice President Kamala Harris hosted a roundtable discussion at the White House yesterday on Black maternal health. We turn to Wisconsin experts to explain what contributes to poor outcomes for women of color. How do you improve outcomes for moms and babies? Join in 800-642-1234. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a profile on an art exhibit that celebrates a community's diversity.
A lot of us have felt isolated this past year. And on top of the coronavirus pandemic, a national reckoning on race has forced many of us to consider our own identities, the ways they overlap, and the privileges they afford. WPR's Megan Hart visited an art show in Manitowoc that looks at how these concepts intersect comes at the perfect time.
On a sunny Saturday in early spring, Sonia Vasquez set up her painting supplies in a bright and airy corner of Manitowoc's Rahr West Art Museum. She got to work finishing a portrait of a man, one of 10 she's painting for a show called Portrait of Manitowoc. She usually starts with a photograph.
And then what I do is lay down a layer of paint, and then I sort of take some of that paint off to reveal some of the lighter spots. So it's kind of a give and take sort of thing with the paint at first.
The paintings are small, but they're rich in detail. Each one takes about 6 hours. Vasquez worked with museum curator Diana Bolander to create the exhibit.
So I wanted to try to find a way to marry those two ideas of, classical portraiture and community art, because you just don't see that very often.
Vasquez chose a group of diverse subjects to expertly render. One is Natasha Kahn, a 29-year-old from Two Rivers.
I thought it was amazing. I knew beforehand that she was an amazing artist, but just seeing it was it was so weird at first, because you usually don't see yourself like that.
The show is designed to inspire Manitowoc residents to consider how they do see themselves. Dozens of self-portraits are exhibited alongside Vasquez's paintings, displayed between two pieces of glass. On the back, each artist answered a prompt: how do you feel about your identity in relation to Manitowoc? Khan wrote about struggling to balance her Pakistani heritage with her Wisconsin upbringing.
I think it's just a great way for people to see different representations of our community, and hopefully they can see representations of themselves and realize that their identity and self is important.
Museum goers might see their neighbors or friends among the artworks. The portraits are all different. Vasquez pointed out a work from a 79-year-old artist who signed her portrait as Gloria. She made a collage featuring daffodils, a cardinal, and one of America's most beloved daughters, whose own work often deals with identity, Dolly Parton. The works from students have resonated with Bolander. Many are wearing masks in their self-portraits, documenting this very specific moment in time. And she says it's been powerful to read people's personal descriptions.
And I feel like it's sort of cleansing in a way for some people. And it's been a real mix, like people who maybe have some suggestions on how to make the community better, and also people who really just love it here and want everyone to feel welcome.
Part of the museum is housed in an 1880s home. Bolander says it's literally a mansion on a hill. She knows it's not a place everyone feels comfortable visiting, especially during the pandemic. So the exhibit will travel after it closes at the RAR West on June 6th.
Sonia has designed it so that we'll be able to send it to other locations after it's here. So people who might not feel comfortable coming here to the museum, maybe they'll feel more comfortable going to a local school or the library.
Bolander and Vasquez want the exhibit to be accessible, and they agree representation is important.
I'm super grateful to have a museum and have people that work at the museum that are super open to making their own museum more diverse.
Vasquez is 28 and half Mexican. She says it hasn't always been easy to connect with that side of her culture in Manitowoc, but she sees the community changing.
I think genuinely most people in the city are, you know, are caring, loving people that, you know, want to have a nice community. But I think there's a lot of learning still to be done.
WPR's Megan Hart brought us that story on the art exhibit Portrait of Manitowoc at the RAR West Art Museum. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now we're talking about Black mental health, maternal health in Wisconsin, and why Black women nationwide experience unacceptably poor health outcomes in pregnancy. The Biden administration has put forth initial steps to address it. Here's Vice President Kamala Harris presiding over a roundtable of Black maternal health advocates yesterday at the White House.
The United States Congress, leaders at every level, everywhere, must take on this issue. It cannot be for Black women alone to fight for their rights and to fight for their dignity.
Are you a Black woman who gave birth recently? What can you share? How is your new baby doing? How are you? 800-642-1234. Keisha Shanks is a public health and infant mental health consultant. She founded The Mindful Mama, providing case management to pregnant women and women with children under age 7. Keisha, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. We also have Tiffany Green with us, an assistant professor in the departments of public health sciences and obstetrics and gynecology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Tiffany, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Tiffany, let's start with you. Wisconsin has the worst record in the nation for Black infant mortality, and maternal mortality for Black mothers is 5 times higher than for white mothers. Why are we seeing these disparities here?
Well, that's a really challenging question, and I think we don't fully know, but we have some ideas. First, I want to say that Wisconsin has long had high Black infant mortality rates, and we've also had high levels of inequality, high levels of Black male incarceration, relatively high levels of unemployment among Black Wisconsinites. The list goes on and on. So those things are necessary for having healthy pregnancies and healthy births and having healthy Wisconsinites in general. So when we have these levels of inequality, we have these levels of structural discrimination, it's not surprising in that sense that we have these problems.
Oh, because one leads to another. It's part of a much more complicated set of situations that you see is driving at this issue. And I think it speaks to Vice President Harris said at yesterday's roundtable, we know why this is happening. And she said systemic racial inequities and implicit bias in healthcare. What do you think?
So,
yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, what do you think of that?
I do. I respect the work that Vice President Harris has been doing in this space. I don't know that implicit bias is really key. I do think explicit bias has a lot to do with this. For example, we have racial bias encoded in some of the medical algorithms we use. For example, if I had a C-section and then at the next birth, I wanted to have a vaginal birth, I'd be downgraded compared to a white woman simply because I'm Black. I think there's been a lot of focus on implicit bias, and while and we don't have a lot of evidence that these trainings work long term, nor that the key driver of disparities in treatment is implicit bias. So I would encourage us to focus on larger systemic issues in medical training and medical practice as a component of why we are seeing these disparities in outcomes.
Keisha, help us understand Black maternal health through your eyes and through your cases, what you see going on with mothers.
Well, a lot of what I see going on with mothers was really reflected in the same things that Tiffany just spoke of. I see a lot of disparity in the community. There is a lot of external factors outside of the medical care that impact birth outcomes and maternal health outcomes. Things such as food deserts, you know, if you don't have adequate access to healthy foods, those things have an impact on child development and on the health of overall health of your pregnancy. Access to clean water. Milwaukee is known for having a very well-known lead problem in the water. So you have a number of children that are testing with high levels of lead, which affects cognitive development and brain development. You have a series of housing inequities and a very long history of redlining in the city. So preventing people from accessing equitable housing and safe housing. You have educational inequities. There are a number of systemic barriers within the educational system. You look at the budgets and things like that for the city of Milwaukee, as opposed to other outlying suburban districts where a lot of the funding is diverted elsewhere. So there's a number of factors in addition to the discrimination and the marginalization that Black mothers experience within healthcare.
Yeah, and so it's really these pillars of society, the food, the access to safe drinking water, the access to safe housing. And so you would really need to optimize all of those things in order to be healthy leading into that pregnancy and then during the pregnancy and afterward. Tiffany, is there a larger continuum here of care?
In terms of, could you clarify what you're saying?
Yeah,
here?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of being able to look at this on a more long-term, a long-term basis, that maternal health isn't just about during the pregnancy or right before and after, that you really have to have these societal pillars in place, if you will, in order to be able to have healthier outcomes.
No, I agree with that. One of my favorite quotes, and I'm blanking on the author at the moment, talks about how programs to improve maternal health outcomes without considering the health of moms are technically unsound and morally illegitimate. And I agree with that, right? We can't start at pregnancy. Many pregnant people don't necessarily plan to get pregnant when they get pregnant, right? And more than that, you know, we know that the roots of these health disparities start in the womb. You know, we know that, for example, in research that women who give birth in low-income neighborhoods are more likely to be low birth weight and give birth to more low birth weight children. And because of that, we need to start early. We need to start with addressing poverty and wealth inequalities, we need to start with addressing the fact that even as children, Black children are discriminated against in medical care, in terms of pain treatment. All of those things need to be addressed far before people get pregnant.
We are discussing the state of Black maternal health in the pandemic, persistent inequities in healthcare in society. Tiffany Green there, she works on this issue in the Department of Population Health Sciences and Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at UW-Madison. And Keisha Shanks is a public health and infant mental health consultant in Milwaukee. You can join in. If you're a Black woman, how comfortable are you seeking care? And what have conversations been like for you in your OBGYN visits? Did you give birth recently, or are you a doula supporting women in labor? How do you feel about the birthing experience in our state? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about Black maternal health. The White House yesterday, it issued a first ever presidential proclamation marking Black Maternal Health Week. It's part of the administration's broader efforts to bring attention to this issue and the racial gaps in pregnancy and childbirth-related deaths. According to data from the CDC, 3 in 5 pregnancy deaths could be prevented. About 700 women die each year from pregnancy complications. And infant mental health consultant Keisha Shanks and Tiffany Green of UW School of Medicine and Public Health, they stay with us for 10 more minutes. Keisha, why might a pregnant mother delay prenatal care or perhaps avoid it altogether or be uncomfortable seeking it?
Well, there's a number of reasons. One might just generally be accessibility. Sometimes it's getting to a doctor's appointments is not an easy feat, especially if you rely on public transportation. And what I'm seeing a lot of with women who are eligible for free transportation through Badger Care insurance is that a lot of times that transportation is unreliable and it's inconsistent. So a lot of women miss appointments because of that. The other part is that there's a lot of medical abuse that happens at doctor's appointments. I've witnessed it firsthand when I'm at doctor's appointments with my mom sometimes. Doctors can be very, and medical staff can be very dismissive to a mother's concerns, especially if she is a poor Black mother that may not necessarily have the vocabulary to express what it is that she's feeling. There's a lot of assumptions made about the health and well-being and lifestyle of Black women, and this happens across all socioeconomic backgrounds. It's not limited to just poor Black women. So we see a lot of those things. And there's also a cultural disconnect. There are a lot of things I've had doctors tell pregnant mothers that it's okay if they don't drink water. If they're drinking Coca-Cola, that's fine. And that's not okay. You would never tell, a doctor would never tell a white mother that. So in a lot of ways, they encourage unhealthy habits because they believe, well, they're not going to do anything else anyway. So what's the point of me telling them otherwise? And it comes from a historical belief that, that Black people are less educated, less informed, and less civilized, if you will.
Let's bring in a call. Zach joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Zach. What is your question?
My question is this. The Bayview Compass recently found out that Shorewood had one of the highest radon levels in Wisconsin. Is there any correlation between the fact that radon decomposes into radioactive lead in less than 4 hours? Have these mothers' houses and their forced air systems ever had their filters tested for radon and lead particles? And I'll take my comment off the air.
Zach,
thank you.
Yeah, Zach, thank you. Tiffany, are there any insights on radon exposure in the homes of these women?
Well, that's not my particular area of expertise, and I haven't seen any studies on this this environmental contaminant in particular in Wisconsin, but I think this would be a good area for study for sure.
You know, I want to talk about very high blood pressure. I can tell you as a white woman, preeclampsia is incredibly scary. You know, very high blood pressure, protein, a very high protein in the urine. But, you know, it's one of the leading causes of maternal death worldwide. One healthcare report said Black women develop preeclampsia at a rate that is 60% higher than of white women. Tiffany, how can we ensure the medical community is monitoring for blood pressure and, you know, something as basic as making sure blood pressure is under control?
So one thing I suggest in a recent article that we published on bias and obstetrics in the Green Journal is that we can think about standardizing protocols. So rather than leaving it up to just discretion of the provider, we can say, okay, we're going to make sure that we check every birthing person for these issues on a regular basis. We're also going to make sure that birthing people have care beyond, especially the beyond the 60 days that they would get postpartum on Badger care. There's been policy suggestions or rather policy implementations where Wisconsin now has the option of extending Badger care past that 60 days to 1 year. And, you know, even though preeclampsia often occurs, obviously before and during labor, it can also occur after birth.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so it's really important to be able to monitor those things. Dr. Kara Hoppe at UW-Madison, one of my colleagues, is implementing some programs with the doulas to try to work with Black mothers to monitor their blood pressure. And I think those interventions are really important. But I think on a systemic basis, we need to standardize these protocols and make sure that all birthing people are being regularly checked for these hypertensive disorders of pregnancy.
Keisha, what do you see as the role of doulas to improve the birthing experience for women of color?
Well, as an infant mental health professional, I think the role of doulas is very necessary because it helps provide a sense of belonging, and it helps to reduce anxiety during pregnancy and childbirth for birthing people. Having someone there that can advocate for your behalf and ensure that your needs are met, someone that can essentially be there to support you. What we're seeing a lot of in pregnancy and childbirth is that the focus is on the baby and not so much on the mom as it relates to just the overall health of everyone. More focus is placed on the baby and not so much on the mom, with the exception of things such as high blood pressure or if mom's heart rate drops or things like that. But having someone there that is actually focused on the emotional and mental well-being of mom during that process is paramount. Hmm. It makes a world of difference.
Tiffany, as we close here, can you look around the country for programs or solutions that have worked elsewhere in getting at this issue that we could implement here? Yeah.
Absolutely. The California implemented maternal perinatal quality initiatives, and those initiatives have been very successful in narrowing disparities in maternal morbidity. For example, hemorrhaging is one of the most common maternal morbidities, and California experienced disparities in the outcome. However, implementing a standardized protocol across health systems meant that Black women actually disproportionately benefited, and thus disparities in that outcome narrowed. Now, that did not address racial disparities in maternal mortality, which is harder to move, but it does suggest that when thoughtfully implemented, that standardized protocols can really be helpful in narrowing gaps from these outcomes.
Tiffany and Keisha, thank you for joining us.
Thank you
for having me.
Tiffany Green, assistant professor in the Departments of Population Health Sciences and Obstetrics and Gynecology at UW-Madison. Keisha Shanks is a public health and infant mental health consultant. Tonight's episode of PBS Wisconsin's digital series focuses on this issue at 7, and this is the Ideas Network.